kind of sampling. There's another kind of traditional sampling oscilloscope where I've used one of those, which allowed to go as high as 24 gigahertz of direct display. And I think there's now a version that goes to at least 50 gigahertz. In other words, you could take, let me drop, you could take a repetitive waveform, and the kind of sampling, traditional sampling oscilloscope I'm now describing, for the most part require a thoroughly repetitive waveform. But if you've got a thoroughly repetitive waveform that you can trigger on, there are oscilloscopes which will allow you to display the, let's call it the sine wave of the RF in any crazy shape it's got, any crazy time domain characteristics it's got, at frequencies well above 20 and maybe even 50 gigahertz. And what's really going on with that particular scope is that you can't possibly put all of that information with all of that resolution into memory on one single pass. The way the sampling oscilloscope of the traditional type works is that it will start off at your trigger point on the very first sine wave. Then it starts off at the very next sine wave and delays the triggering of its memory system by, let's say, a picosecond, and then 2 picoseconds, and 3 picoseconds on the second, third, and fourth sine wave, so to speak. You end up with a bunch of dots on the screen, and when you finally fill out all of those dots, you see the real waveform of the, let's say, 20 gigahertz sine wave. You see the real waveform. However, if the screen has 1,000 dots displaying that particular waveform, let me drop, you're really looking at 1,000 individual events of the sine wave sampled with a little bit of shift on each one. So it took 1,000 events of that sine wave in order for you to put those 1,000 dots on the screen by which you eventually see the real waveform. And I was doing some extremely brief radar-like system. In other words, I constructed at the Edwards Air Force Base in California, at the Benningfield Anechoic Facility, I constructed a kind of radar which had a resolution of, a resolution of 1/4 of a foot. I was in a 350-foot chamber, and I could see every 1/4 of a foot, whether or not there was a reflective object in the anechoic material on the floor or on the walls or whatever. I was getting a very high time domain resolution of the RF waveform that was occurring at more than 10 gigahertz. I was displaying the waveform directly without detection of any kind. The real raw waveform coming out of a horn-like antenna with extremely brief pulses and being displayed on a sampling oscilloscope screen. Properly used, they can come up with magic. In the time I wrote a respected article, let me drop, and the article was entitled Spatial Time Domain Reflectometry. And people would sometimes read the title of that article incorrectly. They said, you're talking about space-time? I said, no way. I'm talking about time domain reflectometry, but being done at microwave frequencies in space. And so ordinarily, a time domain reflectometer is used within a coaxial system to find any impedance perturbations of that system. But I was using this in a chamber in order to find the reflecting objects, the scatterers that were in the chamber, that without this kind of instrumentation would have been very, very difficult. I know we've only barely scratched the surface on very fancy oscilloscopes, and Tektronix is one of the leaders in the United States on that subject. I think Rohden Schwarz has done some work. Nicolect has done some very good work. There's a number of very respected brand names. But the word oscilloscope, O-scope as many people call it, that is an extremely wide field these days, and wow, there's a lot of different models, a lot of different capabilities, there's a lot more there that meets the eye, and once you've got, let me drop.
Get back to K2KE1.
Comment.
Okay, once you've got the right kind of an oscilloscope, and then you connect it to various kinds of RF instrumentation, like a spectrum analyzer, like a vector network analyzer, like a dual differential time domain reflectometer, or a time domain transmissometer. There is such a thing. The dual directional DDTDR and DDTDT, it's called time direction, time domain transmissivity. You put the right kind of oscilloscope on those instruments, and my goodness, you can literally display what's going on in, say, for instance, a coax connector or a cable, a millimeter at a time, and I'm not kidding. Mel first, and then we're going to go back to Wesley, who got us on this path in the first place. Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2QAQ with one more comment.
This is K2KEY. We can leave this subject, Dick, and bring it up where it applies directly to amateur radio application, because we're getting too much into the engineering field of use of oscilloscopes, and I know I'm going to get comments. So if you'd like, we could sometime further discuss oscilloscopes and their direct use in amateur radio. I think most of the audience would be interested in that. Over.
Yeah. Mel is trying to rein in this guy called K2RIW. He's going a little far afield here, bragging about some of the crazy projects I've been involved in. Okay. And it's now getting a little far away from ham radio. Could we, although the guys I know who are on 10 gigs, that's ham radio, and they build their own equipment, and they're using things like this. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead.
Just one other brand I wanted to bring up to you, Dick, was LaCroix. Nobody had mentioned them, and they're also one of my favorites. Very much on the expensive side, but boy, there is a series of their oscilloscope called the Wave Surfers. And these things are really, really kind of neat, and they go to up into the microwaves. But it's amazing what these scopes can do, and the displays are very, very large. They're not the small little displays. They're very, very nice large displays, and their ability to print out and do some very other nice things. I want to hand it back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, another thing that Mel is hinting to me about is that we've really got at least two other people who have signed in. We haven't gotten to them yet. Maybe their eyes are being held up with toothpicks by now. Wesley, it's easy to say that we've only barely scratched the surface on oscilloscopes, and there's a lot we didn't say yet. I know we've created a little bit of confusion. All we've really sort of done is mention some of the headlines here. But oscilloscopes are a darn good subject to investigate further, because if you really want to know what's going on with your circuit, it's one of the best tools there is. A lot of visibility comes out of them when they're properly used. Look what you got us into here tonight, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is November 2XY, Juliet November. I strongly disagree with the statement that we went too far away from the ham radio operation, and I very much agree with that statement, if I can say it kindly. And we went too far, but the simple basic would be very much helpful to the people in Egypt, because few of them could realize that for a few hundred dollars you can have really good oscilloscope, and let's say Tektronix TDS3052B, which is the color digital phosphor oscilloscope you can buy for $1,000, and it will give you the sample rate of 5 giga samples to 9.9 giga samples, and it will actually have 2 to 4 channels if you want to. So, and the frequency response would be, the bandwidth would be 500 megahertz to 699. Okay, so I would like to do a little summary, easy way with the simple language. But three things that are very much important for the oscilloscope use bandwidth is the sampling, and it's a sample memory rate. And the typical analog bandwidth is what it gets 3 dBs down in its frequency response. And at the old time, we had 20 megahertz of the maximum frequency that would be the maximum bandwidth for the oscilloscope. And right now, 500, uh, 500 megahertz you can get for around $200. Now, also I disagree with the fact that the TFT oscilloscopes will actually not show all of these very tiny changes. And there was something that you said about the equivalent time of sampling, naming this particular oscilloscope as a time sampling oscilloscope. Well, what is really important is that sampling at real time gives you all of the variation of the sample, all of that signal, of that wave particles that you're trying to get. And the sampling rate, the typical standard for the minimum sampling rate is actually 10 samples per single sample, per single waveform. And when the frequency get bigger, then you need, of course, the bigger sampling frequency, which 1 gig is, in most of the cases, sufficient enough for somebody who is not very much professional, but he wants to use it. Now, the equivalent time sampling is actually not good. It is only good when you're dealing with a high frequency. For the typical person who wants to experiment with that, it's important how good is the real-time sampling. Now, the sample memory rate, well, it is good if it's from 1 meg and up of the samples. So, but actually the sample rate of that one that I was talking, the digital fossil one, is 1 gig of sample per second. And the next time, not today, because it's we're taking too much. I would like to suggest you, Dick, to get to the Q meters, which actually one of them was on a sale on eBay for $100. That is good stuff, and also explain to the people why these Q meters are no longer in use, and also the LTR meters, what they do and work. Back to you, Dick. Thank you very much, 73.
Yeah, we have other things to look forward to in the coming weeks. Q meters, LTR meters, what do they do? And we sort of glossed over in the case of an oscilloscope, whether you use it in the AC coupled mode or the DC coupled mode and how you adjust the offset controls. A good oscilloscope quite often has a 10-to-1 probe or a unity probe or a probe that's got a switch on the end where you can flip between 10-to-1 and unity. That tells you something about the way the scope loads down the circuit and whether or not there's a small AC signal you want to look to riding on top of a large DC signal. And using the scope in the AC coupled mode can give you a lot of improvement in display and takes a little bit more interpretation and notes going on. Some oscilloscopes, let me drop. Some of them have buttons on the front end where you can force the oscilloscope itself to either act like a nearly open circuit or act like a 50-ohm load. And there's advantages and disadvantages of that. And one of the last things we haven't covered is rise time. A rough rule of thumb is the rise time of the display on the oscilloscope. In the old days of the old-fashioned oscilloscopes, before we used fancy sampling technique, the equation frequently used was 0.3 divided by bandwidth. In other words, if your oscilloscope was an old one and only had 100 megacycles of bandwidth, 1 over 100 megacycles is 10 nanoseconds, but you could multiply that by 0.3, it would have roughly a 3.3 nanosecond rise time. So you take the bandwidth, divide it into 0.3, and it gives you a good approximation of rise time. Rise time is between the 10% and the 90% point of a waveform, like the leading edge of a digital pulse. We're going to leave oscilloscopes now. We're going to be coming back to them. There's a lot more there you haven't heard. The next person who signed in, hope he's still with us, is Ed, K2 Golf Juliet Echo. Hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this stuff, Ed. K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep and watch your watch. Do a better job than I do.
Okay, I heard the beep. This is K2GJE.
Oh, can I talk about oscilloscopes, but I have something, because I used to service tectonic oscilloscopes, what goes on inside of them when you have problems. But I have something else this evening. I wanted everyone to know that this coming Saturday, April 17th, at CW Post, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., there's something called Radio Day, and there are five speakers. The first speaker is W2KFZ, and he will be speaking on emergency communications, the role of amateur radio. Let me drop. Okay. And the next speaker is Woodstock Radio and Me, Pete Fornatel from WNEW. The third speaker is InfoAge, the story of the radio museum at Camp Evans in Delmar, New Jersey. And Delmar, New Jersey used to be a hotel that was used by Marconi to train operators. Then it became an army camp later on. The fourth speaker is on the theremin, the history of the first electronic musical instrument by Kip Rosner. And the fifth and last, My Love of Mystery, which has nothing to do with ham radio, a look back at eight radio mysteries by someone called Herb Norman. I'm going to drop. The admission is $10, and if you want to bring your son or daughter and they're under 12, it's free. There's a food court, and there are many exhibitors. I know last year Limark had an exhibit there. I don't know if Limark is going to have an exhibit. I believe Great South Bay is going to have a station on the air, and the high school, I think, from Glen Cove is going to have a live webcast. So I just wanted to bring this to everybody's attention. Back to Ned.
Sounds kind of good, Ed. Let me ask you, is this the first annual? It sounds like it's not. It's the second, third, or fourth annual, maybe. $10 this coming April 17th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Radio Day at CW Post College, with some good speakers about various kinds of radio, radio communication, emergencies, and so on. So so once again, Ed, is this the third annual, and who is the sponsoring organization? K2GJE. You probably said it, but you'll have to tell me again. K2RIW.
Okay. This is the third annual. The sponsoring organizations are the radio station WCWP there at CW and Long Island Wireless History Society. They originally tried to get the site in West Savo, which was the Telefunken station, and they've since branched out into other things. But those are the two sponsors. You got the price right, and you have the day right. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention, Ed. Sounds like something to look forward to. And one last question. Your involvement with this, Ed, are you putting on one of the displays? Are you one of the organizers? K2GJE, K2RIW.
My involvement is that I'm the treasurer of the Long Island Wireless Historical Society. And just to add something while I have the mic, years ago I was repairing Tektronix oscilloscopes. One of the things that they had internally was a delay line
light going to the vertical plates that was displaying the signal to do some correction, because if you just put the signal across the plates, you didn't get a proper waveform. And the other thing that we ran into, sometimes the problems in the oscilloscope when they were having troubles wasn't solvable, and Tektronix came up with the solution that we had to actually wash, put the oscilloscope in a room where we washed it with soap and water, and then restored all the tubes at that time and the CRT. Over.
Impressive. It must feel funny to take an expensive piece of electronics and start washing it like that. Very fine, Ed, and thank you for bringing it to our attention. Next person on the list was Lou in 2RQ. Lou, many people already know, is a former director of this club. He's held many positions. He's also in charge of education. And what would you like to educate us with tonight, Lou? N2RQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, and everyone who patiently waits here. I wasn't quick enough on the button tonight, so it only took 2.5 hours to get in. One point that I want to observe, and then I have a question, is that you start off the net and you mention email, and that you don't respond to many of them, but that Mel does. The one thing you leave out, and you've left it out every time I've listened recently, is what email address to send to. It's a great mystery otherwise. I'll let you respond to that if you wish, and then I have my question.
Yeah, I'm going to turn that over to Mel to give the answer. And I think part of the reason why we haven't made that super easy, Mel last week got 150 emails. He typically gets 75. And some of these emails are people sending us manuscripts for books and for doctoral theses and whatever. Massive amounts of material, which is a bit above and beyond the call. So where Mel is getting so darn many emails now, and he's having trouble handling it all, I'm going to pass it over to Mel. He can decide if he wants to advertise his email address. And K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Now, don't cheat, that Dick. 168 emails. Now, many of them were, I basically had to peruse over as many of them as possible, and most of them were somewhat giving us some affirmative that what we're doing as far as the TechNet is concerned. Others were, there were a number of them that had suggestions, a number of them that had criticisms, and so on and so forth. So this is what it's come down to, but the ones that I've been able, or I should say, attempted to answer is from a lot of new hams and also people that listen on scanners, and to give them a heads up about certain aspects of amateur radio. Let me let it drop. As Dick alluded to, yes, it's very flattering that people would think that they can send us a doctoral or a master's thesis and that we would be capable of proofreading these different people that are interested in getting a degree in this particular field. However, as Dick says, we never offered a pre-consulting service nor a proofreading service. This is just a little bit out of bounds, and people want to know why, because we do get into detail, as you've seen on the TechNet, with number of subjects. So they figure, well, this is just an extension. If I send it to you in written language, through even the U.S. Postal System, I've got an envelope with pages and pages of technical material that they'd like us to review. And as Dick says, we never offered that. So let me let it drop again. We've got a brief question that we think that we could answer, that you feel that you don't want to bring it up on the TechNet or whatever, or you want me to direct you where you can get the information. The email address is at k2key@arrl.net. Very simple. But I cannot get in. I am also, I think, more of a hunting tech. I don't type that fast, so I can't get into long, expanded reviews nor answers to a number of the questions. I just have to skip over them, Dick. Over.
Well done, Mel. There's always going to be people not agreeing with the way we run the TechNet. No matter how we do it, you can't keep everyone happy. That's sort of a given. We try to look at the common denominator of what people need most, what we can best supply. As you can see, when Mel gets 168 emails, and to a certain degree, each person writing that email thinks he's the only one, and if he doesn't get an answer of his particular question that might be out of scope, so to speak, out of the range of what we think we can handle, the fact that he doesn't get an answer, he can easily get mad at us. When I was writing articles for QST Magazine, I would, on occasion, get 300 letters in the old days. We didn't have email in the snail days. This is snail mail, 300 per year, and I just couldn't keep up with it. And there was a mountain of people out there mad as all hell at me that, hey, I wrote you a very nice letter, and you didn't answer. Come on. I just can't keep up with it. I mean, I had to live a life, and I can give you all kinds of examples of how people tried to abuse that. I won't go there. So, go easy on us on this one, fellas. As Mel said, let me drop. It's not a free written consulting service. It cannot be. We've got a life to live, and there's a lot of people with a tremendous thirst for knowledge in this subject. When this TechNet was formed in 1982, Pip and I, N2FDJ was his call letters then, we thought we would answer people's questions, dry up, and go away in a year. And we suddenly realized that there's a continuous flow of people getting into the hobby who have a hell of a lot of questions, and they don't know a good place to get the kind of answers that they can understand. We're trying to fulfill that. Lou, as an educator, I'm sure you've run into things like this. N2RQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, thank you, Mel. I have a suggestion on the managing of the email, and that is announce that for a given period of time, email will not be accepted until the backlog goes down. And then you can announce it again, stuff like that. The frustrating thing was there was no way to find it. Anyway, my question is a very practical one. I am currently working with two New York City high schools. One you know that I've been with for about 30 plus years now, Brooklyn Tech, call sign W2CXN, Charlie X-Ray November. And more recently, I've been working with Stuyvesant High School, call sign W2CLE, and we've reached sort of an impasse, and I need help in choosing a multi-band HF antenna installation for each of those buildings. And if you'd like some specifications on the buildings, I'm looking for input from any and all to help me decide, because frankly, I have difficulty making such decisions. Dick?
Lou has trouble making such decisions. Dick has trouble making such decisions. Mel has trouble making such decisions. You're in good company, Lou. You know that on the TechNet over the years, we from time to time said over again that when it comes to selecting brand names, that's not quite what we can do for you. I can give you a testimonial about a particular rig that I know and love. You're listening to a Kenwood TS-711A.
oldie but goodie, probably a 1978 piece of equipment. And on the used market, whether you're buying an oscilloscope or a rig, and choose one that people know and love and has got a track record, you can get an awful lot for your money. I'm not a buyer of brand new. Some people think that I'm awful cheap, that I don't do that. But not a lot of real hams by my standards do that. So you're welcome, Lou, whenever you want to pass out your question, to give out your specifications, and hopefully people listening will be able to make a suggestion from their experience. I've used a such-and-such antenna, I put it on the so-and-so school, and I'm quite happy with it. I know I can't answer that one. I'm going to pass it over to Mel for a comment on that, and then we're going to pass it over to the group, see if anyone has a suggestion for Lou. K2KEY, K2RIW, how do you select antennas for schools, Mel?
I have a couple of suggestions, Dick, M2EO.
We're going to go to you right after Mel. Mel first.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, he said the magic word when he said Brooklyn Tech. I graduated Brooklyn Tech back a very, very long time ago. The antenna I used on Brooklyn Tech at the time, we had a radio room, I remember, up at the roof. I don't know if it's still there, that radio room. And the antennas that we strung up there, I remember I strung up the dipole, helped strung it up, but we used the center feed point. There was, on the roof, there was a old flagpole, a big old white flagpole up there. And of course, we couldn't go near the tower, which is most likely still there, which I know is still there. But it didn't have TV on it at the time. It had just FM. It was an FM station. I can ask him. Is the flagpole still on the roof, do you know, Lou, over?
Okay. I have used that flagpole for a dipole. It is no longer there. I would like to give, for everyone, some of the specifications before we go off too far afield, because I have been measuring up there. I have been walking the space with some of the people who are going to help us, but they're asking me to come up with specs, and just like Dick said, everybody's got an opinion. I'd like to give you some of the specs, and if people want to email me, it's n2rq@arrl.net, and I'll wade through whatever responses I get. Both of the buildings are at least 10 stories, and I think the height of those stories on the school buildings is about 16 feet per story, so we're talking about at least 150 feet above the ground to begin with. We must use coax as a feed because of how we have to go through the building. And I'm looking for, because of restrictions of various kinds, I'm looking for something at the moment that would probably be either a vertical or a multi-band wire antenna with or without traps, whatever. But I think it has to be a commercial design that would be durable, because we've got to have it put in at least semi-professionally by school personnel, and we don't want to have to call them back to do service, especially with budget issues these days. So that's the kind of thing I'm looking for. And Mel, go ahead and to our queue.
You can't close the timing out, but you didn't. Let's see if Rich wanted to make a comment first. N2EO, how would you solve that problem, Rich?
Yeah, let's pause there, Dick. I like, you know, I'm sold on it. The Kirchcraft R8 vertical. I like it because it's not a quarter wave, so it doesn't depend upon its efficiency from long quarter wave radios. It's an electrical half-wave antenna. It has 7 4-foot counterpoise radials. It can be mounted on a piece of 1.5 to 2-inch water pipe. Now, the only thing, originally when Kirchcraft brought it out, they said it didn't have to be guide. And then later on, they went back and they came out with something called the R8GK, which is the R8 guide kit. So they now recommend that the antenna be guide in three places, you know, spaced 120 degrees around. I don't know if that's a problem for them, but the antenna covers 10 through 40 meters, including the walk bands, no 80. It's a very, very, very good performer in the lieu of a beam. Back to net and to Leo.
Okay, why?
Go ahead, Mel. And now, if you happen to know the price, and the price of that antenna that Rich just mentioned, you might throw that in too. K2KUI, K2RIW.
Oh, I don't know the current price, but knowing Brooklyn Tech's roof, where I'm sure it most likely hasn't changed much, other than that, too bad that flagpole is gone because it was a wonderful place to tie the center of the dipole up to. What I would suggest is no, the vertical with the radials and all may present the problem, and the guying of it may present the problem that they would, you know, say that it is a trip hazard or a hazard because of the egress there, at least the staircase, if it's still there, I'm sure, for fire hazard. So what I would suggest is putting up a pole on each side and hanging. You can't get away from the old dipole. If you want a commercial version, you can go to a Radio Works. They will have their many multi-band dipoles, including if you want 80 meters involved, great, 80 through 10 meters. If that's what you're looking for, HF, they have a number of them. They are commercial, well, I mean commercial. They're made by a commercial company that happens to make a amateur radio fed with coaxial cable with a balun and all. And it could be raised up to a point where it'd be actually very unobtrusive, Dick. Over.
You certainly get a lot of performance out of dipoles. Let's pass it over to the net one more time. Anyone else have any other suggestions for Lou on appropriate, probably 80 through 10 meters, but maybe 40 through 10 meters, but handband antennas that he could install onto the roof of Brooklyn Tech High School and Stuyvesant High School, both 10-story buildings. Anyone else have any other suggestions for Lou? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, I heard RSO. I think that was one. Who was the other person?
BC2, QIQ.
I heard Glenn. RSO first. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick, my suggestion is that whichever antennas Lou considers, that he go on to eham.net and check out the reviews. As an example, I'm on there right now looking at the reviews for the Cushcraft R8. They show an MSRP of from $450 to $480. It is approximately 25 to 28 feet tall, and yes, it should be guide because it's a little top-heavy. But the URL is www.eham, that's E-H-A-M as in Mike, .net /reviews/detail/529. And that's for the Cushcraft R8. Once there, I'm sure it's easy enough to look up other antennas. Other possible choices would be the Titan DX. I'm trying to remember the full nomenclature on that. The Gap Titan antenna, which I've heard favorable reviews about. And another vertical would be that brand new 43-foot MFJ antenna, which runs approximately $400. I think it's $399. For wire antenna, I read an article recently from Kurt Kleinschmidt, who writes for a number of the publications. Let me drop it for a second. And he was extolling the virtues of loop antennas. Matter of fact, if I read him correctly,
he said that he would trade in one of his three-element beam antennas for the latest loop he put up because it worked just as well, if not better than. And, Lou, if you have sufficient room on the roof for four poles, you might want to consider just running a wire loop, square or rectangular in shape, and with a good antenna tuner and coupler, you probably would get away with a lot less money spent than you would on a good vertical. Those are my suggestions. Back to you, Dick, and to RSO.
Thank you, Frank. Lots of good information in there. Glenn is going to be next, and I also heard a partial sign-in for somebody called NY, is what I heard. We're going to pick you up right after Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2IW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Dick, you know, I'm listening to the height of and the altitude, and at this point, I don't know, I think I might shy away from the verticals at that altitude, and especially with the mounting and seeing that it has to be something that can't be serviced or can't be looked at from time to time. It has to be kind of mounted once and stay there. I think I would have to go back to the idea of, like, even a fan dipole at that altitude, if it's supported with a couple of poles, one in the center, one on each, one on the outer edges, so with three poles, and have a fan dipole that runs across quite a few bands can be covered in, you know, basically one array of poles. Also there, again, to cover even lower frequencies, to go from 40 and 80 meters, if you can configure a loop by putting, you know, four poles in four corners of the roof, I'm not sure how much area you have up there, also very, very advisable. Being that you have to run coax down from the fan dipoles or from your loop, you could use like a DX Engineering balun and then feed your coaxial cable into that and then, you know, tune the lengths right into the balun and get a good VSWR match at the other end of the cable. And I think you'll have very, very good results with that. There again, with the verticals, I think the mechanics of them and being able to not service them kind of is a big negative there. KC2QIQ.
Why again?
Okay, I heard KEY, but let me first pick up NY. There was somebody who signed in from out of area, I think it was an NY in the call. Please give me that call and your name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, very good. Good evening, my name is Mo, Mexico, Ontario, Mo. And I'm in Staten Island, and I'm checking in via IRLP because I can't make the machine via RF. How copy, Dick? Over.
Copy is very good, Mo. Please give us your call letters and then proceed with your comment on what you think is the best antennas for Lou. You got it, Mo.
Okay, Dick. Thank you very much. My call is NY2SI, New York to Staten Island. And as always, a great job running the net. I'd recommend the TrueTalk G5RV. It's an excellent antenna. If you, speaking of eham.net, if you look up the reviews of that antenna, it's got about 150 reviews, and it's got a solid 5 out of 5 rating. It's the True-Talk G5RV. If you have about 100 feet of length, it'll work really well. And I've heard a lot of people on the air using that, an excellent antenna. Back to Matt from NY2SI.
KC2QIQ with a comment about the G5RV at that altitude.
Okay, we're going to try to take these in order. Hey, Mo, that's a great set of call letters you got there. New York to Staten Island. Mel first, and then Glenn in that order. Mel, KC2, here we go. K2KEY, you got it, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, I'll tell you, if that flagpole was still up there, I would bet you that dipole, I and a couple of the other guys, put up there. In fact, the dipole, I knew very little about it when I first, you know, helped put it up, but that was in the 54. The chief engineer at the time, the chief engineer of WNYE was the broadcast station that was up there, the New York educational station, the FM station, and he also became the trustee of the ham station. His name was Tracy Deers. He's a silent key now. In fact, I own his, some of his equipment that he had. And let me put it to you this way. The dipole we installed that time on the flagpole was there for until I left in 58. It was still there. I operated that station every lunch hour, and for the buck, the bang of the buck, you can't beat a dipole. Maybe even a G5RB would work. I'll tell you what was up there originally. One second. On that time, we put up, it was a dipole with a number of, actually, I guess you would call it a fan dipole. Center point was pulled up the mast, that old mast that was up there, the left old flagpole, that was the center point. Fed it with coax directly. I remember we had enough, didn't even have a balance, just a few turns of coax up there. And we had a number, we had an 80, 40, and a 20 meter fan dipole hanging off of it. I don't think we had 15 at the time. Nope, I don't think we had, no, 15, I think, was fairly new band, and we didn't have 10, but I remember running the three bands, and with that fan down, the wind's up there, pretty strong, but it was still there, and I bet it would still be there if they didn't tear the flagpole down, Dick, over.
So when it comes to Brooklyn Tech, there's a man who's been there and done it. Glenn, tell us what your concern is. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, and the VECMAT.
So you see, I'm at a little disadvantage here. I've never been up on the roof before of the Brooklyn Tech building, but one thing that kind of strikes me is the fan dipole sounds like a really neat application because, like you said, you can have a single mounting point in the middle and then basically tie it off on either end or have a pole on either side to basically terminate on, which could be a very, very nice installation. And the ends of the dipole in the center don't have to be tremendously high off of that roof because you're already at a good altitude. The negative side to the G5RV is that it's very, very shape sensitive. In other words, where you want to try to hold the top tee up 40 feet from the where the feed line comes down is basically as a like a ladder line coming down. You want to keep that like 40-foot length down the center straight and then tee it up on the top, which would mean that you'd have to have some kind of like 40-foot pole arrangement on top of a 100-foot roof in order to get the correct response out of a G5RV. I mean, if you hold the G5RV down close to the roof and try to lay the other, that ladder line, feed line off to the side, you'll never get it to tune the way that you'd want it to get the true broadband response out of a G5RV. So that's kind of like the negative point that I see with it on that roof. But maybe it is possible to mount it, but I guess you'd have to really know that layout first. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
He's right.
Comments. Okay, Mel, and comment in that order. Mel, go right ahead with your comment first.
Comments. K2KEY. Glenn's 100% exactly right with the G5RV. I have experimented with that G5RV. If you don't drop that feed line really perpendicular to the antenna, to the two elements of the antenna, it doesn't work right. So you need really a support, like depending on which G5RV, but you usually need a vertical, at least a vertical support of 40 feet high, Dick. So before you put the coax onto it, so that's why I didn't even consider the G5RV. The best way is, like I think what we had originally, is that fan dipole. That, I think, worked excellent up there, and I would highly suggest it. Go ahead, Dick.
2 hours, so comment? Oh, we got two comments, and then Frank, in that order. Comment number one, it's not going to be an easy. Who first said comment? Give me your call letters and name, sir.
K2GJES.
Okay, Ed recognized. And who was the other comment person? Okay, maybe I got confused. You got it, Ed.
Stay away from verticals. Even though they look like they should have no wind load, they have a lot of wind load. I take my vertical down when we have northeasters. Also, I find that the vertical traps have very narrow frequency. Unless you're really in there on either side, you get SWR. Stay away from verticals. I would go for the fan dipole and stay away from the G5RV. Unless you really set that up right, it doesn't perform. Over.
Very fine, Ed. Sounds like some real personal experience on that one. I think the next person was Frank. You want to give us some more words of wisdom? You got it, Frank.
Okay, Dick. I think we've probably narrowed it down to a dipole of some kind, given the various problems with verticals at that height. If I had to make the decision, I would go with one of two antennas. If I were to build my own, I would probably go with an OCF, off-center fed dipole, using a 6-to-1 or 9-to-1 balun, then coax down to the shack. Better than that, if Lou wants to go with a commercial antenna, when I worked for the Corps of Engineers, we had a linear 1,000-watt HF transmitter feeding into a Barker and Williamson folded dipole. That's the B&W terminated folded dipole. Got excellent results with that. My one word of caution, the standard antenna comes with copper-willed wire. I found that the copper-willed doesn't hold up because basically it's copper-coated steel, and if the copper flakes off at any one point due to a chip or a sharp bend in the wire, you expose the steel underneath, and of course it can rust and break. They do sell a stainless steel wire version, and I think that's the way to go. You can go from 1.8 to 30 megahertz without a tuner, although a tuner coupler would probably help. That's my opinion. Back to Ned and to RSO.
If you want IFY, what a comment. KP1IFY or something like that. We'll get to you in a second. When it comes to stainless steel, interesting kind of antenna, Frank. I've done some work at UHF frequencies with stainless steel and had some painful lessons to learn about its resistivity. Most of the styles of stainless steel have a resistance that's just a little bit better than nichrome wire, which people make dummy loads out of, and dummy loads, the best way I can put it. Resistors, you know, wire-wound resistors are made out of nichrome in many cases. Stainless steel is a little bit better in conductivity than that. So it is a kind of a compromise antenna where, because of the resistivity of the wire, it is much wider in its standing wave ratio bandwidth. And so a lot less tuning is required, a little bit of loss of gain, but there are a number of antennas out there that have either a lumped resistor or stainless steel would be a distributed resistor, and it makes tuning a hell of a lot better, probably cost you a dB or so, and maybe that's a very good compromise. Okay, the person I just heard, KB1, I think it was IFY or something like that. Give me your full call, your name, and then your comment, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, very good. I don't want to time out the beep. You got Bill on staff for KB1IFY. I'm using by Radio Works, a Carolina Wyndham R133 special. Seems to perform very well. My only complaint with the antenna was when they manufactured it, they didn't put it together good at the insulators. It came apart on me one end and then the other, and got it back up. It's a very good working antenna. Another antenna you might consider is called the Buckmaster. The Buckmaster has got, to me, it's got better wire on it. So those are two OCF antennas you might want to consider. Back over to you, Dick. KP1IFY.
All right. Thank you, Bill. More information. One last call. Anyone else want to give suggestions to Lou about the proper antennas for the Stuyvesant and Brooklyn Tech High School's 10-story buildings where he's putting HF antennas on the roof? Anyone else have any suggestion? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Looks like you've got it, Lou. And hopefully some of this is helpful. Into RQ, the educator, K2RIW.
Oh, thank you very much, Dick and Mel and everyone in the net. I took a couple of pages of notes, and I welcome additional comments, particularly from experience. People want to email me at N2RQ at ARRL.net. And you mentioned pretty much the ones that I was wondering about. The one thing that was not mentioned was any sort of a trap dipole, and it's rather interesting, but although I'm not sure if the BMW one is a trap dipole. Anyway, I'm anticipating probably doing whatever it would be in the form of an inverted V so that we would get a more omnidirectional pattern. Another time I will ask you about a practical problem about a beam at Brooklyn Tech, which is now approximately 400 feet away from our new shack. But I think that's enough for tonight. K2RIW, thank you very much from N2RQ.
One final comment, K2KEY.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Mel and Glenn in that order. Wait for the beep. You got it, Mel.
Okay. The trustee of the station at the time was Tracy Deers, who was a professional. He was the professional chief engineer of WNYE. And he immediately said, he says, the winds, and of course, that I really later on found them very, very accurate. The winds up there can be really murderous. That's, you know, that's up 10 floors up on that building. And the least resistance, the antenna, that's why we put up at that time, he said, why we put up that fan dipole, because it presented the least amount of wind resistance. And that's why I think it survived up there. Anything with coils or anything, when it begins to swing around up there, you haven't been up there in really, I meant at times when that wind is so vicious that you can't even open the door out to the roof. So I would then suggest, again, least wind resistance. Look into something with the least wind resistance. And that's why I did, again, agree that the fan dipole should be replaced as it was previous. That's my best ideas right now on this, knowing Brooklyn Tech. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds like the right way to go. And if they do put up a vertical, it better be guys. And if it's smart enough, there are ways of putting the guys to the edge of a building on posts or whatever, so that not an interference to a fire drill. But Glenn, KC2QIQ, you got it, K2RIW.
Yeah, I guess what I just have to say here is just to really reinforce what Mel was saying. At that altitude where you're at, that building is already at the height of a tower already. The winds up there are going to be nice and strong. And you already mentioned, you don't want to be going up there and doing any kind of service. Coils and anything else in between, not only do they add weight and a lot of wind resistance, but it's just another thing to go bad. On a fan dipole, you just have wire, good solder connections and good solid mounting. They'll stay up there for years. And the only other thing I could probably advise on top of that is having a nice DX engineering balun coming right down off that fan dipole. And run your coax through, and I think you'll be fine. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Again, there sounds like a lot of common sense here. Any final comments, Lou? And welcome back next week with your other questions. And N2RQ for any final.
Okay. Well, I to tell you the truth, my personal experience with fan dipoles is very favorable. I'm trying to figure out where I can get something that's commercially made like that, but I'll see what we can do. And Mel, I never actually met Tracy, but I did know him by email, by telephone, and by snail mail. And when he became a silent key, I took up the trusteeship. So, yeah, he continued as trustee well into his retirement. Thank you all. I'm going to give it back to Dick. And Mel, if you'd like to come down and visit us directly, first of all, there's an alumni homecoming on the 24th of this month, and we meet every Thursday afternoon. So Don't be a stranger. Nick in 2RQ, be standing by.
And to Leo with one suggestion.
You got it, Rich.
Okay, you know, it just occurred to me, well, check